Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a really great show lined up for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did the other day with Mirtella Maria Jones, who is the grandmother of Ayanna Stanley Jones, a young girl, 7 years old, who was murdered by the Detroit police back in 2010, May 16, 2010. Opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did back at Sundance in 2014 with the filmmaker Hubert Sopper. Hubert's best known for his film Darwin's Nightmare, but his most recent film is called We Come as Friends. And it's opening up here in Los Angeles on the 21st of August and in 20 other cities throughout the country shortly thereafter. All right. And this is a film, a tale of rabid colonialism, imperialism, and savage oppression in Africa, and in particular in South Sudan. And I'm running the first part of an hour-long interview I did with Hubert at Sundance. I really encourage you to listen to the entire interview. It's a mind-bending interview, all right? You're not going to want to miss the rest of the interview. And you can hear that interview in its entirety at soundcloud.com/Michael Slate. Okay, again, that's soundcloud.com/Michael Slate. All right, so without any further ado, let's jump right into the interview. I'm very happy to welcome to the show the director of a film I saw here at Sundance that was just a remarkable film, very powerful. And his name is Hubert Sopper, and people might know him as the director of a film that was out a few years back called Darwin's Nightmare, and he's the director of this new film that I'm talking about, which is We Come as Friends. Hubert, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Nice having me. Thanks for having me.
Definitely, man. Well, why don't you give people, before we start, give people a synopsis of the film itself.
All right. That's a hard one. You know, I've been working for 6 years on this film called We Come as Friends. And if you want me to resume it into one or two lines, it's an attempt. I try to condense a very complicated issue into a movie. Of course, that's my work as a filmmaker. And that is to try to figure out what is the pathology of colonialism? It's hard to explain in a quick way. But there's something kind of encrypted in our veins almost that we, let's say the Western culture, the Europeans, I'm a European, have been overthrowing civilizations, killing, you know, millions of people in the world, and as we did, like annihilate, you say, or mm-hmm. annihilate civilizations over the centuries in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, we always had to come up with a narrative that kind of excuses us for doing this. And the narrative was, of course, supported by Christianity. We, the Europeans, we always had to come up with a way to explain to ourselves that we are actually really good people, while we are killing everyone else on the other side of the world.
And that's a good job, man.
it's a complicated thing, but because it's kind of a part of our civilization, it is very refined. It's I can, if you want to stretch the argument, you know, it's kind of it's a bit of a stretched metaphor, but I can say it, I think, on your radio station, is when you imagine an individual who's a murderer or is a pedophile, or what, let's say a pedophile, and he goes home and he spends a lot of money to sponsor an orphanage. He insists to all his friends how much he loves children. You know, so there's something so pathological in his behavior or her behavior. And I think in a collective way, our civilization suffers from the same schizophrenia, you know. Hmm. And I think it's a fact, and it's something that we have to kind of come to terms with or fight against. But we can only fight against it if we are ready to see it as a problem. You know, I think it's a collective problem. You know, so the movie We Come as Friends is basically it's a very straightforward documentary film, which is set in the South Sudan and in Sudan, at the very moment when the Sudan, the biggest country of Africa, was split into two pieces. And that was a very crucial moment in history, because the division of cultures and countries and nations was a crucial method, a crucial tool of colonialism. So the European colonialists came to Africa a bit over 100 years ago and cut it into 50 or something, 52 pieces, called Nations now. And that is called division of it's called divide and rule, basically. Mm-hmm. The more you divide, let's say, intact kingdoms, the easier it is to rule those kingdoms, you know. And sometimes the borders which had been made in colonial times were also actually containing tribes into one nation which were already at war, which is also a problem. And then it's also easier to rule this new formed nation. So the Sudan was basically the last episode of a long, long tradition of division of Africa. And the interesting thing is, of course, that while it is happening, the narrative which we got in America or in Europe or even in China was that this country has to be split in two pieces because they are so different. The north is Arabic, the south is Christian. They don't get along. They should all have a separate country, and then everyone is going to be happy and it's going to be peaceful. Of course, it's not true that everyone was Christian in the south. It's also true that a lot of Christians were in the north. It's clear that the problem between the north and the south was not religious. It was basically a problem that was created by powerful people who wanted the division, you know, and who wanted the division to basically divide the wealth of the country. And mainly it was or is the oil in the Sudan. But at stake is also the water of the Nile. The Nile River flows straight from the south to the North Sudan. And then on to Egypt. There is an unbelievable amount of gold and silver and uranium and you name it, and a lot of arable land. So, you know, it's a very stretched thing to say, but in some way the Sudan was split into two hemispheres, and I would say into a Chinese hemisphere and an American hemisphere. Hmm. So China and America basically cut this country into two, and you know, this is, of course, a simplified way to say it, but there's something to it. Mm-hmm. And what was not said during this division of the Sudan is what was not mentioned is that everyone was speaking about the new nation going to be born and people are going to be happy and they're all the same. But no one really talked about the fact that there's a new border created, which is, something 2,000 miles long. And typically in Africa, borders are not a very safe place to be. So if you happen to live near that new border, you're potentially in very bad shape. Mm-hmm. And there's a good chance that your children are going to die from some kind of violent action.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come as Friends.
Well, there's a couple of things there. I mean, I'll return to the thing about the pathology of colonialism a little bit later. But I wanted to, you know, part of this thing, even with the borders, I mean, as you're saying this, and you talked about created these two hemispheres, mm-hmm. the Chinese and the American, you know, it's really interesting because there is this point that throughout Africa, I mean, it is true that the borders of African nations, you know, they didn't match, a lot of times they didn't match in way, shape, or form. They didn't match anything to do with what a lot of the tribal areas were, and you have tribes split down the middle. They basically were lines that were drawn in the earth around whatever you can hold with a gun, whatever you can defend, the imperial powers, whatever you can defend, you can have. And so it's true, these borders were very artificial in the sense that, but then they also became battle lines and continued to be like that. And one of the things I wanted to ask, you know, you've done a few other films, a couple of other films, at least I know of in Africa, right? The Kisangani Diary and Darwin's Nightmare. And you can talk about that if you want. I mean, the question I was going to raise to you is, so this would be your third film on Africa.
Yeah.
And is there a development, is there a reason why you keep coming back to Africa, and is there a development and a progression to what you're doing with your films on Africa?
Yeah, one of the reasons why I'm interested in Africa is of course, because I'm a European, and Europe has a very, very, very connected history with Africa. It is completely connected. For example, exactly a century ago, the First World War started to the month almost a century ago, and that war, the First World War, was basically a colonial war. The problem was that the German Empire at the time, and the British Empire, and the French Empire, and the Russian Empire were coming to a point after having developed very high-end industries they came to a point that they kind of realized that they're going to need a lot of resources in the future, a lot of workforce, a lot of like slave workforce from abroad. And each empire was kind of imagining that going to be a shortcoming for someone, right? So, of course, the trigger of the First World War was the killing of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo and so, but the mood that came up to it was a colonial dispute, basically, which is not really written in history books very much. And then, 20 or what years later, the Nazism was the consequence of it. So the colonial history and Europe is so interconnected. By the way, one of the scenes in my film, We Come As Friends, takes place in a place called Fashoda, which was basically the epicenter of the collision of the two big empires in the late 1800s, in 1898. Mm-hmm. That was Britain and France, when they clashed into each other, basically, in a small fishing village on the Nile. And that fishing village was on the crossroads between the two imperial axes. And basically, the British already had like colonized the north of Africa, the Nile, Egypt, and also the South Africa, together with the Dutch, the Boers. And they were obsessed by connecting those two points in Africa. So basically connecting the north to the south, the Nile to the Cape. And the French had a similar obsession. The French had colonized West Africa, most of all Senegal and surrounding countries. And they had military outposts in Djibouti on the Indian Ocean. So the French were obsessed to connect these two points and make a big imperial unity from east to west. And obviously the two interests would cross somewhere, and they figured out they were basically drawing two lines across the continent. And the two lines were meeting precisely in the South Sudan, on the Nile, in a little place called Fashoda. So the two extremely, at the time, nationalistic nations or empires, extremely fascist, I would almost say, mm-hmm. and extremely racist, They were driven by racism. Those two nations were racing for Fashoda, like in 1968, the race for the moon between the Soviets and America, right? Same story. They were racing with a very big investment, with big armies across the continent of Africa, both armies. The French went up the Congo with a steamboat. They dismantled the steamboat, months, thousands of porters, of course, slave porters from local people were carrying the machines, of course, not the French. The French were even carried themselves by locals. And the British were racing up the Nile and the French were faster, and they took this little town called Fashoda. And the British came a few months later and were militarily superior, and they put up their flag also in Fashoda, and they came to a crazy crisis called the Fashoda Crisis in 1898, where both empires were at the brink of a world war, which is 1898, which is like 16 years before the actual world war. So Britain and France almost went to war in Europe over the crisis of Fashoda. And the crisis kind of ended with the fact that the French gave up. The French gave up the Sudan. And this is the reason why in Sudan people speak now French, not French, in English. This is why Kenya is English-speaking and Tanzania. Basically, the whole of East Africa is now English-speaking. Influence because of Fashoda. In exchange, actually, the British said, well, that is nice of you to leave us, to let East Africa to us, and we will give you to the French in exchange Morocco. So Morocco became, as a little cadeau, a little present, a French colony, to the detriment of the Germans, because the Germans also wanted Morocco, and it's just a crazy this whole story. So, and it ended up triggering the First World War.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come As Friends.
So understanding this is what's driven you to make these films?
Well,
or is it just a story?
No, it's like, this is story. The thing is that history is extremely complicated, and history is basically not what happened, but what is being told, right? This is history. What is the narrative? And I think it's important not only what is being told, but how it's being told, And documentary cinema is an amazingly effective tool to tell stories, because you don't only have information, you have, as an audience, the feeling to encounter people, if the film is made well, you kind of feel you're there. You are in front of these people. Mm-hmm. You get scared. You get intrigued. You're confused. I think as a documentary filmmaker, at least for me, I think it's very important to recreate passion that you live as a filmmaker. It's not that I go to Africa and then I come back. I'm going to tell you what the truth is or what the facts are. You know, the facts are being transported by CNN and the BBC. But still, you know, of course, a documentary film is factual. You know, people are real people. No one is an actor. People say what they really think is the truth. But a lot of things in documentary films have to be read in the second and third degree.
What do you mean?
If an officer of the UN shows you a plastic model of the future of the South Sudan, it looks like a little Disneyland or something, and he insists on and on and on how beautiful the future will be and how great it will be. And the more he insists, of course, the more you as a spectator in the cinema would sit back and say, wait a minute, what is he trying to tell me, right? But I'm not going to be over-voicing this as a filmmaker. I'm not going to say, look, he's a liar or something. Or mm-hmm. I just let people speak. And sometimes, you know, so to say, I give them enough rope so they can hang them themselves, you know, with their arguments, with which I think, of course, I have clear opinions, of course, mm-hmm. as a, in some way, also political activist, you know. But I think the efficiency of a documentary film like this is not what you see and hear, but what you feel and what you understand between the lines sometimes, mm-hmm. you know.
I'm going to come back to that, actually, because that's something I did want to explore a little bit. But I have to ask you, too, before we get too far into lose this. Your perspective from the film is shaped in a very unique way in a plane that I wouldn't sit in, even if it was on the ground, because I'm scared of it. Talk about how you made this film.
When you started a documentary film project, it's really a big chunk of life. And one of the biggest questions you ask yourself is, what am I doing? Why am I doing this, and how am I doing this, and how is my access to the places and the people I want to film? So the procedure, the normal procedure would be like you call people, you say, can I go film you? You apply, you call to, you know, authorities, you apply for visas, and you go through embassies. Let's say you want to shoot as a documentary filmmaker in a Chinese oil field in the middle of a war zone in Central Africa, you may as well take like 15 years to get a permission, right? And you may as well just never get it. So one way to find access is a certain form of anarchy. So we built actually a small flying machine, as you said, like a flying lawnmower, basically, which is named Sputnik, because Sputnik is the Russian word for companion. Mm-hmm. And it's a tiny machine, but it's actually has a very powerful engine. It has very big wings, and big wings means that you can't fly very fast, but you won't die if you ditch it into a bush. So and you can land on a little strip of field or a football field or a country road or something, which we did. And then we went from France all the way down to the North Africa, along the Nile to the Sudan, and literally fell from the sky into military camps, into Chinese oil fields, into UN camps, and we were facing very amazing astonishment every time. Of course, people were saying, like, "Where the hell do you come from?" You know, and in some cases we really had to land because we needed fuel and food and we needed to sleep somewhere and so. But sometimes we kind of use it as a Trojan horse, you know. It's like we fell from the sky and we said, look, we need your help. So we were taken in and we were treated nicely and we connected to people very easily because this flying machine looks so ridiculously small and inoffensive that people took pity for us too, you know. So they said, like, you guys, good that you're still alive. Come have dinner with us, you know. And then some guys wanted to go for a ride, so we took them for a ride just to connect. Some people wanted to see their house from above, and so we go for a little ride. And then in exchange, they would tell us about their lives. How this kind of filmmaking works is I was in this tiny airplane with my great friend Barney Broomfield, and we were literally and figuratively high. You know, this little airplane was our kind of LSD. We were in it, and we were so happy to be up, and we were so happy to having escaped from the military every time. And we experienced this extreme place and this extreme way of living. We were in extreme situations in a very passionate way. And we had a lot of fun, you know, we were laughing our asses off sometimes, you know, just the way, how ridiculous we were ourselves in pilot shirts, how crazy everything got, and how we just escaped in the last moment from another, you know, dangerous situation. And we were so passionate about the beauty of the people we met and how amazingly great their analyses are sometimes, you know. Sometimes very poor people would tell you something so smart and so strikingly beautiful. And we, Barney and I, we experienced that really as a team. It's like, did you just see what I saw? Or did you see how beautiful this old woman just looked at us or something? Whatever, you know. And because we kind of shared this passion, we could also make these kinds of images passionately. And then it's in the images, if you want it or not. It's like a magical thing, you know. It's almost it's a magical thing. And then you as a viewer in the cinema, you get struck by that same lightning, you know, if things go right. We would also, of course, we did something which is not in the movie, actually. We were constantly filming and editing our own trip. And we had a little projector, and we projected the film that we had made so far on the white canvas of the plane. And so we kind of organized cinema evenings sometimes where people would see themselves with what we just shot that afternoon. And, you know, the kids would scream, you know, it would be amazing, amazing atmosphere. And
what a trip.
So we were almost like a wandering circus, you know, mm-hmm. and flying circus or something, you know. And that gave us a special position. People then, after a few days, knew we were the crazy guys with the little airplane, and they came along. And, you know, all these scenes actually we had shot, and I had planned to include it into the film. Our trip and our mishaps and our problems with the military, which were very, very often. Because, you know, the military, mm-hmm. they don't necessarily like, you know, clowns with a little airplane looking from the sky with cameras. It's a menace, you know, it's a threat.
Which brings up the point about the military uniforms you were wearing.
Yeah, I'll say this in a second. But what I was going to say is, like, all these things that we the Westerners, bringing a nice little film to these people, I didn't want to include it in the film because I didn't want to be one of these good people that bring food and the good white person mm-hmm. who does all these nice things and makes a change and so. So actually, myself, I'm a bit in the film, but more like a lost figure, you know, like a figure, like somebody who's kind of overwhelmed by what he sees, mm-hmm. which was also a case, you know. So you see me in a few cases in the film, but not necessarily in a position of somebody who is superior or who brings biscuits for the mm-hmm. children in Sudan, you know. But as you said, the uniforms, so in our flying tin can, we landed. I was held for a month in Libya, which was still then was still Gaddafi's. Mm-hmm. I was just held up because I just was this traveling guy, and I was wearing T-shirts and blue jeans. And later on, same thing happened in Egypt. I was treated like because they said we were. Permissions are not good enough, your plane doesn't have the right insurance for our country, whatever, there's always something, you know. And I had to go to the Ministry of Defense in Egypt, which is a very awkward place to be as a flying clown, you know. And so I was handed from one general to another, and they all wanted to check me out, and they thought I was Mossad or CIA, so I had to, like, insist that I'm not CIA, or, you know. And, of course, they didn't believe me, so they didn't want to let me go, you know, so... And when they did let me go, I was like flying like a couple of hundred miles and then got to the next airstrip, and then they said, you're grounded again. Another week of delay. So it was really, really hard until I kind of understood that when you deal with these uniformed people, you kind of have to become one of them, you know. So we started wearing pilots' uniforms And I had four stripes on my shoulders, and I became, I kind of muted into a captain on this flag, on this, and which is on its in itself a very colonial thing, you know, the uniforms. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of muted into a colonial person. From then on, the journey was much easier. Mm-hmm. And then we came to an airstrip, and then I didn't talk to the little soldiers anymore. I just asked, where is the commander? The commander came up and saluted us and was very happy to greet us. And it was very formal and suddenly. And we, of course, we were laughing. Like we were just, it's just so ridiculous, you know. If you'd see the, I mean, if this is radio, you can't see the little Sputnik, but it's just outrageous, you know. So.
It is an incredible flying machine.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come As Friends.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Yeah. I read somewhere where, at least in the early stages of entering into this film, you had recommended to some people that they read King Leopold's Ghost to get sort of set them in the sense of what you were trying to do.
Right.
Talk about that a little.
Well, King Leopold's Ghost is one of the most beautiful books about the devastation of colonialism. It was written by a friend of mine, Adam Hochschild, who's an amazing scholar. Well, in the title, it's already kind of emerges that it's not about the King Leopold, which was the Belgian king who owned the Congo, which was like 20 times bigger than Belgium or 100 times bigger or something, you know. He owned it, he had never been there. And why the title is so good that it's King Leopold's Ghost is because this is exactly what I said before, it's a pathology of wanting to dominate something you don't even know on the other side of the world and to submit and subdue and slowly assimilate and militarize and exploit and kill. King Leopold killed indirectly 10 million people. 10 million people. Which was by then, I think what Adam Hochschild said, was about half of the population of the Congo. And it happened in the dark because not many people had, you know, video cameras at the time. Mm-hmm. Nobody had little airplanes to look from the sky. Nobody had access to these places. It's a very, very, very sinister history. And the scary part of it is that this history is not over. It is not over. One thing is, you shouldn't forget this, when the Europeans colonized basically the whole planet, right, with arms and with guns and germs mm-hmm. and diseases, they would carry the smallpox and the flu into the Americas and India would die from I don't know what. So the diseases always worked in favor of the colonizers, except in the center of Africa. The center of Africa, which means basically the south of the Sudan and the east of the Congo, is the very, very core of Africa. In that place, the diseases worked in favor of the locals because the colonizers, the Boers, the white, would come and they would die from malaria. The locals wouldn't. The cows of the British settlers would die from tsetse fly or I don't know what, and the cows of the locals would not die. So the reason why east of the Congo and south of Sudan was not colonized is not, has no other reason, I think, than diseases. It was just too wild for Europeans to get there. And now, in 2011, you know, with the big jumbo jets, with billions of dollars, and with air-conditioned cabins of the UN camp, and with very high-end medical equipment, we can do it. It seems almost like the whole planet decides to crack down on the last people who are kind of still free from our way of living. And it's almost like we're obsessed by something under our skin. We're obsessed by something that we have to kill off the last witnesses of human beings who remind us what we were once, maybe, or so. I don't know what it is. You know, there's something really, really, really perverse in it, you know.
You know, you talk about this pathology of colonialism, which you're just referring to again. You know, and how do you see that in relation to the existence of a worldwide imperialist system that enforces economic and social relations that are geared towards doing anything at all to get profit? And that's the key motive. And I've, you know, look, I traveled through different parts of Africa over the last couple of decades, and you know, you could see, and you know that you see the things when you look at this. Yes, there's, you know, you could step back and say, sort of the first impression, it's a pathology, but that pathology is rooted in something bigger. And that's what always got me, is, you know, understanding that there was something much bigger that was, you know, determining, for instance, why Namibia, there was an extinction of the Herero people. There was a genocide against the Herero people.
The Germans, yeah.
Yeah. And it was all driven by this need for profit and this death, because if they don't do it, somebody else is going to come in and get it.
It's a very difficult question. You know, why did the Germans go after these people in Namibia? Why? I mean, was it only profit, or was it some kind of collective brain damage or something, you know, that the Germans said, well, those guys are the others. They called them the Negroes by then. In German, the Neger. And they had to be hunted down. But it's psychosis. It's not only, I think, a drive for profit or for... It's a subconscious madness, I think, also. Not only, of course, but also. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the story of Namibia well, but, I mean, maybe these tribes were in a place where the Germans would have found gold or something. I don't know precisely where...
Right. You could look at Kenya.
Right,
know, I mean, I remember a friend who was born in Kenya and eventually had to leave. They used to tell me about the British having... skeet shooting contest, skeet shooting.
Shoot people. Yeah.
But they would shoot people. Yeah. And the aristocrats, the landed gentry, would stand around and they would whip the Africans to force them to run into the field. And then they would
shoot them
like they were skeet.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and when you think about that, it wasn't just this like sickness they had, but there was a whole view, you know, all the social relations, the whole view that they have of African people is rooted in. And it impacts this point about profit, but it's also rooted in there because they enslave people, they dehumanize them, and then anything they do to them, they're working them to death, starving them for, you know, just work them until they drop dead and bring in 1,000 more, you know, and it's rooted in something much bigger, I think, than just a screwed up brain. You know?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. What I do know is that now, let's say 100 years on, to that story you're just referring to, of course nobody on the planet really would say I want to shoot people in Africa. Nobody, most people would say we should help them, save them, support them. But the scary thing is that as we say that we want to support them, we also destroy them. That is the scary part, because what I saw very clearly in the East Congo and in the South of Sudan is that a lot of people were very, very capable of feeding themselves very easily, and they have gardens, they have cows, they have food, until somebody comes along and says, like, all the young guys who are strong, come with me, get a gun, we're going to go after the other tribe because they want to claim the contracts for oil. And the guys who are fighting, they don't even know what oil is, you know, at that point, you know. They don't even know how to shoot, they don't know how to wear a uniform, they just want to have life, you know, they just want to live, you know. But the guys who come, let's say the warlords, they know how to wear uniforms because they were growing up in missionary schools, you know, and they developed over generations a very deep rooted disgrace for people who are not yet close to Jesus or close to Allah or whatever, you know. I'm saying this because the Muslim colonialism is just the same. You know, if you see it from the perspective of a Central African village, if foreigners come with the Bible or the Quran, it's like absolutely no difference for them. It's like they're foreigners, they speak a language you don't understand, they wear clothes, they tell you what to do, they tell you have to march in step, they tell you you have to sit quietly, you have to listen when somebody prays. All the spirits and all these beautiful things that you until now thought was kind of religion is no longer valid. Now we have a different kind of God. It's one God, and so on and so forth. Only that is so violent. What I'm saying is that this African elite, which is either indoctrinated by Mohammed or by Christ, whatever, want to do everything they can to assimilate the not yet assimilated people to God or Mohammed. So it's a very scary thing, you know.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with filmmaker Hubert Salpaire about his new film, We Come As Friends. And don't forget, the film is opening up in Los Angeles on August 21st, and it will be opening up in 20 other cities around the country shortly thereafter. And once again, you want to hear the entire interview I did with Hubert, you can go to soundcloud.com/Michael Slate. We're going to take a quick break now and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Janelle Monáe with a powerful new piece, Hell You Talkin' About, a very fitting song for our next segment. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my guest, Mirtilla Maria Jones. Mirtilla is the grandmother of Ayanna Stanley Jones, and many people will remember the horror that came down on Mirtilla's life when police in Detroit broke down her door and murdered her 7-year-old granddaughter, Ayanna Stanley Jones, in her arms. Mirtilla's here to talk with us about what happened that night and her joining the struggle to fight against this kind of police slaughter, this kind of genocide that's being unleashed against black and brown people all over the country. Mirtilla, tell us a little bit about what happened that night.
Well, it was shortly after 12:30 midnight, and my door was kicked open, and a flashbang was through my front window and my front bedroom window. And so I rolled off the couch. I was at one end of the couch, and Ayanna was at the other end of the couch towards the door. And so I rolled off the couch automatically and spread my arms and legs, spread eagle, as they call it. All of this happened, like, simultaneously. The flashbang, the kicking in of the door, as soon as he entered, a shot rang out. I was screaming for them to let me get my granddaughter. But by the time I was saying this, he had already shot Ayanna in her head. And her eyes flew open, and blood automatically started coming out the right side of her mouth. And her eyes just started dimming, and the light just went out of her eyes, and I knew she was dead.
What a horror. Did they ever explain what they were doing, kicking down your door, using the flashbang to get into your house and just opening up fire on you and your granddaughter? How did they explain that?
Well, they continued to say that I grabbed the officer's gun, which is not true. I was way on the other side of the room. It was anywhere from 8 to 12 other officers, SWAT members, I guess, because they were in riot gear, and they entered my house and started going through my house, each bedroom. When they got to the bedroom where Ayanna's father, who was my son, Charles Jones, and his fiance, Ayanna's mother, Dominica Stanley, and their three boys were laying at, I just started screaming and asked them, please don't kill the rest of no more of my grandkids, please don't kill them. And I turned around and looked, still laying on the floor, and they had brought Dominica, the three boys, who I believe were five, I believe Pierre might have been two or three, and the baby Christian had just been born that February, that Valentine's Day. And my son, Charles, they brought them all out the room. And they had my son crawling on his hands and knees like a dog with guns. All these had guns on all of them. He crawled to the couch while I was laying near the couch. And he started picking up stuff off the couch. And he said, Mom, what is this? And I just shook my head. He said, Mommy, what is this? I said, that's your daughter. That's your baby girl, brains and blood. They done killed your baby. did in church for baby girl. Dominica was put on the arm of the couch where they had just blew her daughter's brains out. With the door open, with a newborn baby in her arm, no blanket over the baby. They had no respect for any of us. Another one of my sons, the one who was in the front bedroom where they threw the flashbang, they had him only in his underwear, handcuffed, laying in the glass. They wouldn't even let him get up out the glass. And I kept on yelling and telling them, y'all done effed up, y'all done effed up. I don't want to cuss on your radio station. But I kept telling y'all, MFs done effed up. I said, y'all done killed my seven-year-old grandbaby. All she was doing was sleeping. Why did y'all kill my MF and grandbaby? Why did y'all do this? Nobody would pay attention to me. One officer finally, I guess, listened to what I was saying and turned the light on in the room. And he looked at Ayanna and he was like, oh, and grabbed her up by her arm. And when they got outside, my daughter was outside, one of my daughters. And she said another cop grabbed her by the legs and they just carried Ayanna like a doll. Her little head just swinging back and forth in blood and brain matter just all on the porch and all on the house. They said they put her in a police tank and took her to a hospital. St. John's is very far from where I was staying at. And it's a hospital called Children's in Detroit, Michigan. They fly kids from all over the world, all 50 states, because they specialize in childhood trauma injuries. They could have gotten Ayanna to the hospital in 2 to 3 minutes in their police cars, even though I knew she was already dead. They instead took her the hospital they took her to was far. They didn't wait for one of her parents to go with her because both her parents were present. I think that was wrong. They told me, don't move. I went, crawled over to my son, and I hugged him and held him. They can't make me not touch my son. And after a few minutes, they let me sit up on the couch beside my sister, who also witnessed it. She was 60 years old at the time. She had early onset of dementia, and she witnessed her great niece being murdered. So I'm sitting by my sister, and they asked me to come outside. Miss Jones, would you step outside for a minute? I stepped outside. I was slammed up against the house in handcuffs and taken down to homicide. And if Ayanna was in D.C., why was I taking the homicide? The reason I think they arrested me because I asked to see the warrant. It didn't have my address on it, and people are still living in that house on Lily Bridge, and it's clearly two different addresses. It did not have my address on it, nor anybody's name was on it that was in my flat. Nobody's name. It had one name and one address, which was for upstairs. I heard them tell them, I guess, 48 hours to turn the cameras off. And a few minutes later, they come walking in with my daughter's ex-fiance, Chauncey Orm, who stayed upstairs along with my daughter and his daughter. They brought him down in his underwear and handcuffs and set him on the couch where they had just killed Ayanna. And so I think they were staging, they lied right then. The papers say I was harboring a fugitive. That boy did not come out of my house. They went upstairs and got him and put him in handcuffs and he didn't have on nothing but his drawers and brought him in my house so it can make it look like they got him out of my house and I was hiding him. And then people are talking about the fact that they came a year later after Ayanna's dad, which is my son, Charles Jones, because he supposedly supplied the gun that was used in a murder 2 days before. If they even thought that my child, Charles Jones, had anything to do with a murder 2 days before, they would have locked him up that night, regardless of the fact that they killed his daughter. They would have locked him up. If they thought he had something to do with it, my address and his name would have been on that paper. And now my child is doing 40 to 60 years for a crime he did not commit. The only crime was committed against him when Officer Weekly. His nickname is the Brain because he's the first one in. I tell people to go Google him because they had a show here in Detroit called Detroit SWAT. And his name is the Brain because he's the first one in. He lied. He just lied. They said my story wasn't consistent, but his story changed so many times. I basically done lost track of how many lies he told. he got on the stand. He said, I grabbed his gun. Then they said it was a tussle with a lady in the kitchen over a gun. Come to find out later, because they had arrested me, they claimed my sister tussled over a gun with one of the officers, which I don't know if she did or not. Even though she had early onset of dementia, I can't see my sister grabbing a gun. And if she had it, they'd have shot her, too. My son is doing 40 to 60 years for second-degree murder that he had nothing to do with. They say they surveilled that house for 2 days. My son sat on the porch and watched his kids play. He sat on the porch and played with his kids. They claim they didn't see the toys. The video shows all of those toys because we pull them up to the front of the porch at night. They is so wrong. Like I said, they would have arrested my kid that night regardless of the fact that they killed his daughter if he had anything to do with Jerry and Blake's death 2 days before. In his impact statement, when he was convicted, sentenced, he told Cooler Mama Cargill, from the parent of one murdered child to another, you have my sympathy, but I did not have anything to do with your child's murder. And if you putting me away makes you feel better, then I hope you got what you wanted, because you're taking a man away from his sick surviving son. Now my mother got to get out here and help my fiance raise my son. And my sons are good dads. Both of the ones that are locked up are in. People just point at them and they lock your kid up. I don't get it. I don't get it. How somebody can just point at your child. It was him. And they can lock your kid or take your kid away from their kid. I need my boys out here, well, my men, my sons, who finished raising their children. I have 8 children, aged 36. My baby will be 23 next month. I have 2 women and 6 men. 5 of those men are daddies. Because that's what their children call them, dad or daddy. They don't call them father. They not the type to just put them on nice gym shoes, outfits, and buy the video game. They put in time with their children. And so for them to lock my children up, Norbert Jones and Charles Jones and these Detroit, Michigan prisons, and then they sent them so far away, I can barely see my kids. I have not seen Charles in over 2 years. I don't have a job. I'm a poor mom. I'm trying. Right now, my friend Vicky is sitting here with me to give me support for this. And I got like 6 or 7 of my grandkids out here. And you can't hear them because she's trying to keep them quiet. But this is not right. And I need people to stand up. Rise Up October. At first, we were trying to get 100 families to New York. But a friend of mine named Andre, she issued a statement and challenged that 100 families. She said, we want to see 1,000 families of police brutality out there marching. We do peaceful protests. We march peacefully for our loved ones. This police brutality needs to stop. Not only the shooting and murdering of innocent people, you ripping a family apart when you take away. I have lost so much behind this. I have lost so much. 2 more of my grandchildren have passed away. 2 of my sisters, my nephew. I could go on and on how many people I done lost just because Ayanna was murdered May 16, 2010 by Officer Joseph the Brain Week. Oh my goodness. I don't know what else to say.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Mirtilla Maria Jones, the grandmother of 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones, who was murdered by the Detroit police on May 16th, 2010. That's a very powerful, very enraging story that you've just told. I'd ask you this. The police, nothing at all has happened to the police in the wake of all this, right?
He had 2 trials. The second trial, they blame on me. They say I'm an actress. Because I felt somebody staring at me, and I was trying to concentrate on the prosecutor's face. And you could tell when somebody's staring at you in a good way and a bad way. This was not good. So I finally looked around and see who was staring at me. It was Joseph Weekly. And I just told him I wouldn't wish this on him. He has 2 daughters at Ayanna's age. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. If my eyes were 20/20, I wouldn't donate them to nobody because nobody deserves to see their loved one get shot to death by the very people that are supposed to protect and serve them. And I'm issuing a challenge to people out there listening. Don't just talk about it. Be about it. Get up. Pick a side. Which side are you on? Are you on the side to stop this police brutality, this tasing, this beating of people by the police? Or are you going to sit on the side and say, that's a shame. It's wrong that they killed that kid, but what was the kid doing or the police need? No. The victim needs everybody's help. Someone asked me, what y'all think y'all going to do? What y'all think y'all going to get out of this? I said, eventually someone's going to pay attention because these police need to be held accountable for the murders that they commit. They need to be convicted of murder and taken away from their families to see how they love. Because it's not cool at all trying to take care of your kid. Your kid calling you, telling you, mommy, I'm hungry. They supposed to feed them when they in prison. Three hots in a cot. Well, that ain't what my children get. My kids call home saying, mommy, I'm hungry. And they're 30 and 32 years old. Do you know how that makes me feel? They wasn't hungry when they was out here. So why did y'all lock them up just to starve them and keep them away from raising their children? I should be somewhere on a vacation because I done raised my kids. I done raised my great nephews and nieces along with my kids, helping to raise my grandchildren, a host of my family members I raised or helped raise. My children would bring their friends home, like, mine ain't got nowhere to go. And I let them in. Make you a pellet on the floor. My mama used to say, oh, well, it's a pot of soup. All we got to do is add some more water, baby, and everybody going to eat. And that's the type of mother I am. Yeah, okay. Also, one of his cronies got on the stand and said my house was a crack house. He said, when we entered the crack house, and he was asked, how do you know it was a crack house? There were blankets on the wall, army on the windows. I'm from the old school, baby. I'm 52 years old. I was born in 1962. My mom used to put blankets and quilts up to the window. I didn't try buying that $20 and $25 roll of plastic, and my kids and grandkids tear it up, and that's tearing up my money. So I'm old school, so yes, there were blankets and quilts up to my window. They keep the air out better anyway in the wintertime. This is Detroit. This is Detroit. And so I don't know.
Yeah. Martella, let me ask you this. You said you were on a tour, that you've been on a tour. What has the tour been about, and where have you gone, and what have you been saying?
I started on the tour at the end of July, about the 23rd, if I'm not mistaken. I took Ayana's, one of her brothers, he's right up under her, Carlos, he's 9, and another one of my 9-year-old grandsons, Deontay, because Carlos is very... This has him messed up. When they went and arrested his daddy, they held guns on them, my 3 grandkids, again, as they arrested his daddy. And so can people imagine what goes through that kid's head? He was only like 5, 6, 7 years old when all of this happened. First, the police kill his sister. Then they come and put guns on him and take away his daddy. Well, I started with the Revolution Tour, like I said, at the end of July. And on August 3rd, I left out for Chicago. We stayed there about 4 days. We went on from there to Ferguson to march with Mike Brown's father and a benefit dinner his mother gave. What I hope to get out of this, like I say, I'm not going to hope. What I know I'm going to get out of this is a change in these laws and these statutes. These police will be held accountable for all this murder and all these beatings they doing to people, all this tasing. Because when you do take away a family member, like I said, you start to break down the family structure. And some families ain't as strong as mine and fall apart altogether. We have some cracks in our foundation, but I feel them because I refuse to let them take down a whole family. They can't have mine. And I'm coming after them for my son. My sons are coming home to their children where they deserve to be. They try to make Charles out to be this villain. Talking about he was talking something. I forgot what they said. But they didn't play the tape. We didn't hear what he supposedly said. But they didn't say how Charles helped his kids over the phone with their homework. They didn't say how Charles says his prayers at night with his kids. That's the type of men that I raised. And they took these men away from their children. My son Norbert has a daughter he's never laid eyes on because his fiance was pregnant when he turned himself in because he was scared because they said consider him armed and dangerous. We're going to bring a change. Rise up October. Which side are you on? You have to pick a side because there's no middle ground. Because next it could be your family, your love. Now, I done seen it happen. Well, ask me, it's been 5 years. Shouldn't y'all been and moved on, get over that? How in the hell do you get over watching your 7-year-old sleeping granddaughter be murdered by a Detroit police officer that's sworn to protect and serve her? She's a citizen. And all her last words were to me. She rubbed my face. She said, Grandma, you're so pretty. I love you so much. All I want to do is turn 8. Every year we celebrate Ayanna's birthday. She's 13 this year. She turned 13 July 20th, and she's a teenager now.
Martilla Maria Jones, thank you very much for telling your story, and thank you for putting that challenge out to people all across this country that they need to step up against this and to step out for Rise Up October, October 24th in New York City. Thank you very much, Martilla.
Thank you for having me. I'll see y'all in October. Rise up October. All right. Which side are you on? Thank you.
All right, Martilla. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Martilla Maria Jones, the grandmother of 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones, who was brutally murdered, shot in the head by the Detroit police. All right, that brings us to the end of another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Janelle Monáe and her really great new piece from Wonderland Records and that whole crew she's with, Hell You Talkin' 'Bout.
Kimani Gray, say his name. Kimani Gray, say his name. Kimani Gray.